bacon on top.
I think this.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to Daniel. Let's begin with prayer. Lord God, teach us about the life of a believer who lived in a place hostile to you. Lord, we live in a place where many are ignorant of the Lord. We live in a place where some are hostile to the Lord. Help us to learn how to best witness and to let our light shine in the dark place that we happen to live in. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, how did you do with the format during this week? I hope at least some of you were able to do the homework and dig a little deeper than we would be able to just on a Sunday morning. A couple of things that I forgot to mention last time. You probably noticed once you got into the very first lesson that it asked for Bible helps. I meant to recommend getting a Bible dictionary, and also that our library has quite a number of them. You might want to check it out on your way out of church today and maybe check one out. Another suggestion would be, like on that question about Nebuchadnezzar, use the internet. There's so much information at our fingertips these days that whenever you need any type of help with this study during this summer, don't be afraid to use something like that as well. Nebuchadnezzar is just a guy from secular history that you will learn many facts about off of the internet. He doesn't particularly have a spiritual bent to him. I mean, he believed in his gods, but especially if you're looking up one like that, you wouldn't have to worry, you know, that, well, maybe you're getting somebody else's spiritual spin on the question you're looking up. For those type of questions, you might want to rely on a Bible dictionary. But for the question about Nebuchadnezzar, go on the internet. He's an internationally known historical character. So I will pass this around a little bit later because I've marked the spot about the language and the learning of the Babylonians, and then you'll be able to take a closer look at it. Okay, our assignment for this week was to read Daniel 1 and then to answer the questions. I've got the worksheets. I did it again. You can pick up the one for next week. I break these chapters up into bite-sized pieces so that you could break it up into a devotion on Monday, devotion on Tuesday, devotion on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, so that you could do it consistently throughout the week, or however you would like to do it. Also, you're not going to be checked on your homework, so if you choose not to be one who does the homework, you're welcome to come in and listen to all the wonderful discussion, but of course you'll get more if you do the homework during the week.
Thank you.
Okay, let's begin with Daniel chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. Okay, you were asked to read those two verses for the first segment, for the Monday segment this week, and to answer these questions on the worksheet. Find out more about Jehoiakim, king of Judah, by reading 2 Kings 23 and 24 and 2 Chronicles 36. When did he reign, and what climactic events happened during his kingship? I'll pass around the sign-up sheet. Pastor Carr, thanks. Many of you put your email down last time, but if you put it down last time, you don't have to put it down again. But if you didn't, please add it to the list. It's just going to help with Bible class communication. What did you find out about Jehoiakim? Paul?
He reigned for 11 years.
609 to 598, right in that area.
Okay.
And
11 years, Paul says, from 609 to 598 B.C.
He's about 25 years old when he became king.
Mm-hmm.
And he was kind of a puppet king. He was not wasn't loved very much by God. He was kind of an evil king. He was mm-hmm. not, didn't follow the will of his, and some of his ancestors like Joaz and Hezekiah. He didn't. Mm-hmm. He wasn't one of the good kings. He was did evil in the sight of the Lord, it says.
Good. He started, Paul says, I specifically set us up in the round here, too, to hopefully make it more of a discussion, conversation that we have. So please speak up when you give your answer and be thinking, you know, don't just give it to me, but give it to your brothers and sisters here. Paul mentions how he was 25 years old when he became the king of Judah. And he was not a very good king. He tended to follow in the footsteps of the evil kings of Judah that had gone before him, rather than some of the good kings, like Hezekiah, who was also an ancestor of his. Anything else that you found out about Jehoiakim? Yes?
Yeah, I read that he had squandered state funds building a castle, you know, creating creature comforts for himself, but not particularly helping the people.
Okay. Squandered state funds, building a palace for himself, but not helping the people. I didn't come across that one, but Sue?
Jeremiah had prophesied about things to come, and he just kind of burnt those scrolls, and he didn't want to hear anything from his prophets.
Good. He opposed the prophets. Jeremiah had foretold some things about the future of God's people, and Jehoiakim even took the scrolls and burned them. Did you come across anything else about his treatment of a prophet?
Didn't he kill, was it Uzziah?
I think it was Uriah that I found in the, yeah. There was a prophet by the name of Uriah that Jehoiakim had murdered even. So it was somebody who opposed the prophets. Anything else? Maybe just one little fact that I'd bring in. He was very typical of these kings of Judah at this period before the time in the exile, in that he introduced into the temple of the Lord idolatrous worship practices. That was very common for the kings that led up to the time of the exile, that they would always go to the gods of the Canaanites and want to bring in sacrifices to Baal or some of these other gods. They were very eclectic. It wasn't that they completely denied the Lord, but they always wanted to cover all their bases. And Jehoiakim was one of these two who led the people into idolatry.
I seem to read that also he was there when Nebuchadnezzar came and the first time and took Daniel and mm-hmm. some of the primo crop away mm-hmm. in the earlier part of the captivity. But it seemed like he, almost like he repented somewhere along the line where he after a while, he rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I read something, and I don't know if it was, he got his religion back or not, but I don't think so, because mm-hmm. it never shows that he did. But he, somehow then Nebuchadnezzar took him captain, put him in these bronze chains, bronze irons.
Bronze shackles, yep. That was in there too.
Hauled him away also
mm-hmm.
into Babylon.
Yeah. There seems to be a little uncertainty about Jehoiakim, some of the things he did, or some of the motives behind the things that he did. So we can't speak real definitively. But Paul brings up a few facts that are pertinent. It was early in Jehoiakim's reign, the first time that Nebuchadnezzar came to Judah. And he took these cream of the crop young men, Daniel and the other three men, and there was a period of time where Jehoiakim paid tribute to Nebuchadnezzar, where he would have to send him like taxes to this higher king to indicate that he was below Nebuchadnezzar. But I believe it was 3 years after that, it was stated that he rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. And the footnote that I was reading in the Concordia Self-Study Bible pointed out how that was a time when the Egyptian king tried to get things rolling again to defeat the Babylonians, who had already defeated them at the Battle of Carchemish. And it seems that because the Egyptian king was starting to show a little spine, that Jehoiakim was thinking, well, maybe this is a good time for me to rebel and try to get rid of Nebuchadnezzar. So he started this revolution, and it didn't work. Nebuchadnezzar led an army from several different nations in and once again conquered Judah. And it's mentioned in 2 Chronicles that bronze shackles were placed on Jehoiakim. But the question is kind of open as to, well, did he imprison him? I think some people have even asked the question, did he take him to Babylon? It seems toward the end of his reign that there are quite a few questions that come up because the historical accounts just aren't very complete about him.
This is kind of stupid, but is there a reason why they have to tell you that it's bronze shackles? I mean, not just shackles?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, they're kind of like, okay.
I don't know why they would put that little detail in there when there are bigger fish that we'd be interested in frying, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Anything else on Jehoiakim before we move on to Nebuchadnezzar? Okay, then question number two. Using a Bible dictionary, find out more about Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and write down a few main details about his life here. What did you find on Nebuchadnezzar? I remember this in my first Bible story book that my dad gave me. It was his from when he was a kid and trying to sound it out. Nebuchadnezzar is what I came up with. And he had to tell me. No, it's Nebuchadnezzar. Chris?
I found that he was pretty famous for his buildings in the capital city of Babylon.
Yes.
And he constructed the Hanging Gardens of Babylon for his wife.
Good. I'm going to pass around. Chris brings to mind the city of Babylon. Here's a painting of a reconstruction of it. He built these famous Ishtar gates. And then on the inside, you can see hanging gardens over here, a ziggurat temple, kind of a pointed, almost pyramid-like temple.
What's a hanging garden?
Nobody knows how it worked. They were called the hanging gardens, but the archaeologists have dug up the area and have not found any remains of them. But the Greeks considered them so lovely that they considered them one of the seven wonders of the world. You can take a look at what the artist thinks the garden looked like, but we're not sure why they're called hanging gardens. So he really was a builder, and he built out his capital city. He had built this huge empire that we need to talk about more, but it was very important for him to have this focal point, this capital city from which to rule. What else did you find out about him? Paul?
Well, I found out he was probably one of the most feared kings in the history of the world.
Mm.
Every time he went a war against you, he won. He didn't lose.
Yes.
And he always surrounded himself with the cream of the crop of every country.
Mm.
And he was very, very intelligent, probably.
Mm-hmm.
I'm adding my little. I mean, somebody that would pick the cream of the crop and then introduce them into the Babylonian lifestyle.
Yes.
Bring them on board and then use them.
Yeah.
He could get the best out of everybody.
Yeah. And Daniel's a good example of that, right?
Right.
Yeah. Paul says he's one of the fiercest, most feared men in history. Great conqueror, I mean, conquered many different people, and then had a sense for taking from these various peoples the best people and using them in order to further his empire. Norma also had her hand up.
He thought he could get more cooperation from the people by letting them worship their gods.
Mm. Norma came across a statement that he thought he could get more cooperation from these conquered peoples by allowing them to worship their gods. And through most of the book of Daniel, it does seem to be that way. There's going to be a few instances where that's forbidden, but for the most part, Daniel, even though he's in the limelight, is allowed to worship his God. Anyone else? Penny.
Usually
particularly when he conquered a country, he would pull the people out of that country, except for the very poor, and put other people in there, therefore mixing everybody up, and so no one could conquer, it's harder to conquer him back.
Mm. Good. Mixing the populations so that there's not a concentrated group of one nationality that starts saying, hey, let's conquer Nebuchadnezzar. Let's get back at it. Wayne.
It was noted that God used him for a purpose.
Okay. God used him for a purpose. That's going to be a clear theme in Daniel, that God uses even these powerful rulers of the leading nations who do not believe in him. God uses such men for his purpose. Trish?
He was mentioned over 90 times in the Bible, and that's more than any other foreign god. I mean, for a king,
for king.
Part of, I mean, a foreign king.
Mm-hmm.
He was mentioned more than 90 times.
More than 90 times, yeah. That is fascinating, because here we have this historical character who, you know, if you read history, everything backs up what the scriptures have to say, and he is a major character in the Bible. So that, you know, that's a comfort to us in considering what we learned last time, how people will sometimes try to question these Bible accounts and say, are they really accurate? Or were they written much later than they appear to have been written? And then there's all kinds of inaccuracies in them. Yeah, that's an excellent point. David?
On a secular note, he was in power for 43 years, which meant that, I mean, you think of generations. That's two generations of people growing up with his institutions, his leaders, his rules.
Yes.
So very, very influential.
Long reign, right? And since he's powerful over so many different people, a man like that is going to touch the life of many, many people. Yes. Anyone else on Nebuchadnezzar? I didn't hear anybody mention his dates. Anybody have them there?
603.
I think depending on which one you, which dictionary you look into, you probably get a different date. The one I had said 605. 605 as the beginning of his reign, and 562 the ending of his reign. So from 605 to 562. The early part of his life is interesting too, in that his father, anybody come across his father's name? Nabopolassar?
Who wouldn't know how to pronounce it?
No wonder you didn't volunteer, huh? His father had already started the empire building. His father had crushed the previous empire, which was the Assyrians, and then he began to consolidate an empire of his own. And as the climax is coming, where the Babylonians have to defeat the other greatest power in the Middle East, is when the change in ruler took place. It all built up in 605 BC, at this Battle of Carchemish, that was, if you have your map from the introductory materials last time, Carchemish is almost on the top center of your map, and you can kind of see the sweep of history, the directions that nations would travel. Here is Babylon, down here in what is today Iraq, and they're moving west and northward. And they're going to go, because this is the way you would travel. This is where there's vegetation and everything. This is desert here. So you would not go directly this way to Egypt. But they're going this way over the hump to get to Egypt. And the Egyptians come up and meet them at Carchemish. And I'm not sure how old Nabopolassar was at that time. But his son, Nebuchadnezzar, is the general who leads the army to this battle. And Nebuchadnezzar wins the victory over the Egyptians, thus making the Babylonians in charge of all of the Middle East. And just shortly after that, his father dies, and then he becomes the king of this great empire. So he really had a very quickly moving rise to power. It wasn't like this was a kingdom that had existed for a long time. This was one chieftain in the Middle East, Nabopolassar,
who is able to defeat the previous empire and then build an empire of his own. And this empire that Nebuchadnezzar then is the main ruler over is sometimes called the Neo-Babylonian Empire. I don't know if you came across that in your reading. And the reason Neo is put in there is because there had been a Babylonian culture way back, much earlier in ancient history, that was also a very powerful empire. But now, Nebuchadnezzar, living hundreds of years after those rulers, was doing like a renaissance of the Babylonian culture. And so this particular kingdom is called the Neo-Babylonian Kingdom, and it really didn't last all that long. It was around about 70 years compared to some of the other ones. Any other questions or comments on Nebuchadnezzar? Trish?
When he did his building, he used kiln-fired bricks instead of the sun-dried bricks, and he had his name stamped and dated in them.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Good point. I would really encourage you to use some of the other Bible helps, you know, like dictionaries, and the one I'm sending around is my atlas, which also has a lot of pictures in, and that will really enrich your knowledge of what the cultures are like. I came across a few pictures too of those bricks, you know, that he had his seal or whatever stamped into them to show that, you know, Nebuchadnezzar is the one who built Babylon. He's the one in charge. Anyone else? Okay, let's move on to the third question then. Why would the Lord, the God of Judah, deliver, I was intrigued by the word deliver there, deliver the king of Judah into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar? This is the king of Judah's own God who does this. Why? Rich?
He's spreading them out.
Okay, that could be one of God's purposes, right? God wanted the Jewish people to be spread all over the world as a way of spreading the message about how God was sending a Savior into the world. That could be part of the reason why the Lord delivered Jehoiakim into the hands.
I'm not sure of this, but didn't Jeremiah prophesy this also? Wasn't it Jeremiah that prophesied that this would happen to the people if they did not change their ways? And they did, of course, they did not.
Yes.
And
Jeremiah and numerous of the prophets, right?
Yeah,
who said, because of the idolatry of Judah, they will be delivered over to the hands of this other nation of Babylon. Wayne?
I mean, Paul said it before, that he won everything he went into, so I mean, he's just going to go do it.
Who's the he you're talking about?
Nebuchadnezzar.
Okay. Yeah, Nebuchadnezzar wants to conquer this land of Israel, so since he's so powerful, he's going to do whatever he wants to do. However, I would say Daniel's wording is intriguing then, if you approach it from that angle. Why doesn't Daniel say, and Nebuchadnezzar captured the king of Judah and took over his country? Why does it say, the Lord delivered him into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar? Sue?
God's in control of it. He's using Nebuchadnezzar. He's using it actually for the good of his people, you know, to bring them back to trusting in him and not doing these things that they weren't supposed to do.
God is the God of history, isn't he? We, from the human perspective, think we are the ones who do things. We influence what's going to happen. Our decisions shape and mold our world, right? Daniel would not agree with us. It is the Lord who is in control of the universe, right? He shapes and designs history. And we are simply his servants. And a big point of this book is going to be, even those who don't believe in him are used for his purpose. What was Nebuchadnezzar's motivation in conquering a place like Judah? Mark.
Well, they're disobeying him. That's one of the things, because it's like they said, hey, we're not paying tribute to you guys anymore. So, and he's just like, that's not going to happen. We're going in there, we're going to clean this up and take over, and you will do what we say.
Exactly. Jehoiakim had rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar knows if anybody rebels against you, you have to crush them, because otherwise you will not be the most powerful person in the world anymore. So it's a power trip, right? I want to control the whole world. What was God's motivation in having it happen? Pam.
Wake his people up,
right? There is some punishment involved in this idea of delivered into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. Paul told us earlier, he's one of the most feared men in history. The people of Judah had to be shaking in their shoes whenever Nebuchadnezzar would come in their direction, right? And Jehoiakim, he was gambling on this situation we were talking about, where the Egyptians were starting a counteroffensive against the Babylons, and he's kind of jumping on board and saying, well, maybe I should revolt. This would be a good time for me to get my independence back. And he plows right into this terrible, you know, snowplow that's coming in his direction. Paul, you had another question?
Yeah, I think in, like Daniel, almost like Moses back in Genesis, the sovereignty of the Lord is present. Mm-hmm. He knows the past, the present, the future. So his sovereignty is going to happen.
Yes.
My plan has been put into place. No matter how I go about doing it, mm-hmm. I'm in control.
Yes. Moses had learned that, right? In the movements of peoples that went on in Moses' day, where the children of Israel had gotten down into Egypt and had become slaves over a 400-year period, and then how God moved them up out of Egypt, delivered them from that slavery. Moses learned about the sovereignty of God, right? That God is almighty. And also Paul said that he is a God who knows the past, the present, and the future. Daniel is going to be learning this same lesson. These two points are really going to weave together in the overall theme of Daniel. It's going to be a theme about how God is in control of the universe, how he guides the destinies. Norma, you had your hand up as well.
Didn't he just want to change the whole area to Babylonians, their culture, because then he had the names change?
Yes.
Babylonian names, right?
Exactly, right. Nebuchadnezzar's motivation was he wanted to make everyone Babylonian. In a couple of verses here, we're going to see how he changes the names of these four young Jewish men into Babylonian names. So everything has the stamp of Nebuchadnezzar on it, right? Like Trish was saying, all the bricks had Nebuchadnezzar's seal on them. He's trying to make a world in which Nebuchadnezzar puts his name on everything. Norma?
Mm-hmm. And Daniel was one of them.
Yes.
So now how old was he?
Daniel must have been a young man too, because we have a question later on that says, how long did he serve? And I believe, let's see, he started here in 605. And he served until 539, which would be almost 70 years. So he couldn't have been over 20, could he? 15 maybe, because even then he would have been 85, the last we hear of him in the book of Daniel. So he must have been very young. I don't think a full-grown adult yet. Okay, anything else on the Lord delivering? Paul?
One of the commentators had a great point. I thought it was worth mentioning. He said, we must remain devoted to our principles and committed to our course of action no matter what the circumstances.
Mm.
So I think this book of Daniel is going to show this.
Yes, isn't it? Yes. One lesson we must walk away from this book with is that we, as believers in the Lord, stick to our convictions. Yeah, we must, in the face of all kinds of opposition, from the most powerful, from the fiercest leaders, we must stand our ground and not bow down to the gods that they make and tell us to bow down to, right? Or not pray to the king in the case of Daniel and the lion's den. Right? Good point. Okay, let's go on to the fourth question then, which is still for Monday. On the map in the introductory materials, trace the route of the Jewish exiles. How far was their journey to Babylon? Did you see the route marked out there on the map? And then you had your key or your legend that told you how many miles was every so many inches. What did you come up with?
About 700.
About 700 miles, right?
750.
Or 750, maybe. Something around then.
725, okay.
Notice how they would always go around. You had a measure from Jerusalem here up around again. Because this is the Arabian Desert here. And whenever they would travel back and forth, the whole Middle East in ancient times had two poles. It was always this area around Mesopotamia, around Iraq, and then Egypt. Those were always the main powers throughout ancient history. But whenever they would travel, they would go up and around that Arabian Desert so that there'd be water for their animals, their camels, whatever they traveled on. And so you had to go around in a big arc, and you come up with about 700 to 750 miles. So quite a journey in those days, right? Today we can get on an airplane and travel there so quickly, but with the price of gas, we may be going back to this route.
Camels.
Yes, in the near future.
Would that be approximately, what, a two-month? Would anybody kind of figure? I figured about a two-month ordeal.
You think 2 months?
Yeah, to get from, that's a long journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder how many miles they could make in those days.
10 miles a day?
Well, I would think with the captives, they were probably all walking, right? I doubt whether the army would have provided animals for them to ride on.
Could you cover 10 miles a day, you think? That's what I'm guessing.
In a hot climate like that? 10 miles, you think, a day?
I don't know.
In any case, an arduous journey, and for people who had lived in such a small country for such a long time of their history, this must have been like, you know, being thrown into outer space, I would think. The land of Israel, I sometimes do it on overheads where I can compare California to Israel. The land of Israel today is about from here to Reading, is the length of the land of Israel. So you can imagine then 750 miles across in this very hot, rocky terrain was quite a journey. Okay, let's go on to the Tuesday materials. Why would your... we got to read the scripture. Verses 3 through 7. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that, they were to enter the king's service. Let's see, I'm supposed to go on to 7, huh? Mm-hmm. Among these were some from Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names. To Daniel, the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach, and to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. Okay, let's take a look at the questions in connection with those. Why would King Nebuchadnezzar want to take some of the young Israelite noblemen and educate them? Louisa.
He may potentially be ones that would rise up against him in the future if he weren't able to cultivate them.
Okay. Good point. He's trying to educate them in the Babylonian ways so that they don't remain in their own culture and perhaps spawn a revolution at some time in the future against the Babylonians. He's going to take the brightest and best and try to make them into Babylonians. Any other motivation that you could think of?
Well,
I thought it also weakens the country in which he captures. Because he's taking the very best out of it.
Yes.
You know, so he's not allowing them to, you know, advance very fast.
Yes. He's taking them out of their country, and that decimates the country then, right? A few years ago, I don't know if it's still going on, but Britain was complaining about the brain drain that was happening in their colleges and universities. American universities were going over to Britain and recruiting all of their professors to come over to America to work at American institutions. And the British were really lamenting that a brain drain was taking place in their country. I think that's something similar to what Nebuchadnezzar is trying to do here. Any other motivation that you could see for it?
Train them for government services.
Train them for government services, right?
They're young, you know, train them right away.
Yeah. They're young, impressionable, right? Train them at that time and put them to work for the government. Put them to work for my empire is what Nebuchadnezzar is saying, right? I need the brightest and the best. So he's trying to take the best in the world. This is part of his campaign of conquering the whole world. And then taking the best from every nation and using them for his purposes. It's a grandiose plan, isn't it? David?
Yeah, and I think also to turn them into Babylon. These people are well treated. They're well fed, they're yes. educated, and they're not being treated with cruelty at all, as far as I can tell from
them. Yes.
So to create loyalty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really good point. Nebuchadnezzar feeds them well, right? He wants them to like the Babylonians. He wants them to become Babylonians.
But one of the other commentaries said that they took not only the men, but the women. The good-looking, the best, the youngest women also with them in that journey, along with the men. It doesn't mention them in the Bible, but one of the commentators made that. I don't know where he got his information from, but I don't know if you've heard that.
No, I haven't heard it in connection with this, but it would make sense, too, because you think of women like Esther. You know, she ended up in the later period when the Jews were conquered by the Persians. You know, she ended up playing a very important role in saving the Jewish people. And it was because of her attributes, her beauty, her wisdom, her, you know, and she played her role very well. So a commentator could be assuming, well, that same thing would have happened in this exile. Anyone else? Kathy?
I just think that's interesting. He changed all their names.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, he's almost like saying, okay, you're not where you came from anymore. You're going to be what I'm going to make you, and now this is your name.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, everything in their past didn't matter.
Yeah.
And now this is who they were going to be, and I'm going to name, like, they're my children, and this is how I'm going to raise them, and this is how they're going to be.
Yeah.
I mean, names even. I was thinking that was just... Because names in the Bible were really important.
Exactly. Yes.
And I mean, they name them, you go all through the Old Testament, this was begot of that, this, that, and the name was so important, he went and just changed their name. Yeah. And I think that is like a major deal.
Yeah. It's almost a little underhanded, isn't it? It's almost like identity theft.
Yeah.
Really, isn't it? Take away your old being and re-coin you, recreate you into our culture. Sue?
It seemed like the name changes, especially the three... They were huge changes, but the change was picking out their god to putting in like a Babylonian god.
Exactly. Let's start looking at those names, because that's a very important point in what Nebuchadnezzar is doing here. Well, I guess we got one question before that. Let's take care of that. What was the language and literature of the Babylonians that these four men were being taught? What did you find out about that?
Aramaic
is the common language that's being used, right?
But they also had their own Babylonian language, which was very high in language, I guess, for the sciences and the maths and the astrology. And,
yes.
You know,
And they also had older languages. Did anybody come across what the other languages were that the Babylonians knew?
I came across Chaldean.
Yes, Chaldean is one. Mm-hmm.
Sumerian. And Akkadian
is another one. Right. These were all from earlier empires that had existed between the Tigris and the Euphrates River. And these Neo-Babylonians, they felt like the heirs of these ancient cultures, and they kept them alive as best as they could. Did anybody come across the type of writing that they did, like with the literature there? Sue?
Cuneiform
was the type of writing they did. I'm going to pass around my Bible dictionary now. Part of the reason is because I want to encourage you to get a Bible dictionary. I always say about this one when I pass it around, this was a gift from Myrtle Brown, many of you know her, way back, long before I knew St. Mark's existed. Myrtle and I first met on the East Coast when I was vicaring in Washington, D.C., and Ray was working in the Reagan administration. And Myrtle is the consummate Bible student, and at the end of the year, they were moving back to Sacramento, and she said, I've bought some books, and the particular Bible class I was in, she said, I want you all to take your pick of which books you want, and I got the Bible dictionary. So this came from Myrtle Brown over about 20 years ago, and it's a one-volume Bible dictionary, which I think is really helpful. But like I said, there are many in the church library that you can check out if you don't want to go ahead and buy one. But don't forget, too, that online resources are very rich these days that you may not even have to buy a volume. In any case, as I pass it around, I've marked the page with the cuneiform writing. They wrote in wedge-shaped letters. The ones that look familiar to you are only giving you R equivalent letter, so you can hear the sound that that letter makes. But you can see that these were all just made with what looked like a pen, but it just had a wedge at the end of it. And then in these soft clay tablets, you would just put that pen in there and you'd make wedge shapes this way and that way. They look somewhat like Japanese characters. But they're all just, you can tell, they're all just little varieties or combinations of wedge shape things that this pen has put into the wet clay. It's called cuneiform, and that would have been the old type of literature that Daniel and the three men would have studied. Akkadian and Sumerian and Chaldean, all these languages were written in this cuneiform. However, the first language that someone mentioned here seems to have been the common language among the Neo-Babylonians. It is called Aramaic, and that language comes from Aram, which is the area just north of Israel. Today, and sometimes in the Bible too, it is called Syria. It's the modern-day country of Syria. And since it was so close to Israel, their language is very similar to the Hebrew language. The Aramaic people, whoever speaks Aramaic, write in the exact same letters as the Hebrew people. And it really is just a dialect of it. I started studying chapter 2, and that chapter is Aramaic. So I really had to start slogging through my Aramaic, which is just different enough from Hebrew that I only got through about 11 verses this last week on it. But you still can make it out if you know Hebrew. You still can make out this Aramaic language. So the three men and Daniel would have studied Aramaic as well. I was reading this week that probably the reason the Babylonians took it over is there was a small group of people who migrated from Aram, from Syria, and went down toward the Persian Gulf and settled there and brought the Aramaic language there. And because it was a language that got spread from one culture to another, it became a cross-cultural language. So that at the time of Daniel, Aramaic was the common language that was spoken. You only spoke Hebrew if you were a Hebrew. And you only spoke Assyrian if you were an Assyrian. But Aramaic became somewhat of the common language. I compare it to English today in that English is spoken in so many different countries. It's probably the most common language used around the world. Aramaic was this way too. It was a rather common language. Okay, anything else about the language and literature of the Babylonians?
I read one time, and the book was on the Great Pyramid, and it was about the high-end math and science that was available that may have been lost through history. They were much further advanced than we were today in their math through these languages.
Yes.
And their study of these languages and how they used science and astrology and math.
Yes.
to get things done. It was much higher end than we even have today.
Yes.
I don't know.
The ancient cultures like Mesopotamia and Egypt were very, for their day, they were very technologically savvy. They knew math and science very well. As a matter of fact, in some cases, they knew it better than us. And some of their knowledge has been lost over the years. And archaeologists are only rediscovering it again. For the Neo-Babylonians, especially ones like astronomy, were things that they delved into. And since it was mingled with their heathen religion, it was kind of a mix of astronomy and astrology. Anything else on language and literature? Okay, then let's get into those names because they are really fascinating. What did you find for the names of the four men? Daniel means? God is my judge, right? The next one, Hananiah. The Lord has been gracious, right? And you can tell with these, a Hebrew name almost always ends with either Ayah or with El. And the reason is because Ayah is the first syllable in the Lord. And the El endings, El means God in Hebrew. And so whenever it ends with an Ayah or an El, you can tell it's Hebrew and that it's telling you something about God. Because the name of, it's like, Hebrew names are like little sentences, like the American Indian names were little sentences. You know, the movie Dances with Wolves. It tells you a little story. Same way in Hebrew. God is my judge. That's a sentence all by itself, right? The Lord has been gracious. And every time the person's name was said, everybody who spoke that language understood the phrase that was being said. Mishael is?
Who is like God.
Who is like God. Or who is what God is maybe a more literal translation. And Azariah is? The Lord has helped. You see how the Ayah always means the Lord? Azar is the Hebrew verb for help. And Ayah is part of the Lord's name, that four-letter name of the Lord called the Tetragrammaton. The Lord has helped. If you took it in the correct word order, it would be helped the Lord. Because they put their words in a different order. The Lord helped. Okay, now they're changed. What is the meaning of the changed names? Belteshazzar.
Bel.
That's the first part. And that was one of their gods in Babylon. Bel.
Protect his life.
Protect his life, right? Bel, protect his life. Shadrach.
Aq. Moon god.
Yes. That one contains Aq, the moon god. The end part of it there, that Ach, Shadrach, Ach, Aku, was their god of the moon. There's a little bit more.
That is a Sumerian sun god. Aku was a Sumerian sun god in one of our islands.
And we got moon god, and I think, I can't remember, I think I looked it up in my Hebrew dictionary, but I think also the new Concordia Self-Study Bible gives moon god for it.
Yeah, interesting.
I got moon god.
But it's a little bit longer than just Aku. Anybody find anything else out about it?
Command of.
Command of Aku, right. Command of Aku. Meshach? Yeah. Do you see how they just took some of the names and retranslated them into the Babylonian language with the Babylonian god's name replacing the name of the Lord? This one means, who is what Aku is? His original name, Mishael, meant who is what God is. And the fourth one, Abednego.
Nebo.
Yeah. Servant of Nego or of Nebo. Evidently, there were two different spellings on that God's name, but he was also a Babylonian god. Now, our main question here is why? Why would the four men have allowed this to happen? Why would they allow themselves to be called by these names?
Because later on, they're going to go into the fiery furnace for their God. Daniel is going to go into the lion's den. Why would they take the names of these gods? Dan.
Would it be difficult for the Babylonian people of Babylonian culture to pronounce their names, Hebrew names?
Perhaps. Perhaps they're just accommodating themselves to the culture. The people there, the Babylonians, aren't going to be able to pronounce their names. We'll take a name that they can pronounce. That happens all the time here in America, right? I go out for teriyaki a lot, and I've discovered that it isn't this way in all Eastern cultures, but the Korean people will invariably take the names of Julie and Cindy, and because and I'll ask them when I get to know them, well, what is your real name? And they'll say it, and then I'll say, oh, that's nice. Because they're so hard to pronounce.
Michelle.
This is just a stab, but they might be waiting to pick their battle.
They may be waiting to pick their battle, Michelle says. They don't feel that the name thing is the thing to bring the conflict to the fore. Yes.
Just another thought about the names and changing their names. It's almost cultish. You know, I think Catherine was saying, you know, your past does not exist. We tell you who mm-hmm. you are. We tell you everything.
Yes.
You are a part of our culture.
Yes. We're taking over your whole life, and we're going to change it, right? We're going to remake you. Trish.
Well, one of the books I was looking at said that a lot of the times they took these young men and they made eunuchs out of them. So it was a way of redefining who they were, even as people. And so when you change their name, it's like when you're having all this stuff done at once, a name change is nothing compared to what you're going through, a new environment, a new culture, a new everything.
Yeah, maybe we don't have all the details, and the option was, would you like to become a eunuch, or would you like this name? Did anybody come across a parallel to this in their study? I came across during the week, this one had completely escaped me before this, and I don't know why, in Genesis chapter 41, verse 45, in the story of Joseph, remember the Joseph of the Old Testament, who interpreted the Pharaoh's dream and then became the second in command in Egypt, it says there, Pharaoh gave Joseph the name Zaphnath-Paneah and gave him Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, to be his wife. Joseph does not refuse to do it either. And I wonder if this was a very customary thing, that if you went to a foreign country like this, and that if you were put in a certain position, it was the normal thing to give you a name, and whether that name wasn't more the title of your position than anything. Joseph, you know Joseph's character. He certainly would have been someone who would have spoken up about God. He told Pharaoh, I can't interpret your dream. Only God can interpret the dream. He was very open. He did not hide his faith at all. But in his case, he simply accepts this Egyptian name, marries an Egyptian woman who happens to be the daughter of a priest of one of these other gods. And we don't hear Joseph objecting to any of this at all. This is just part of the honor that's given by the Pharaoh to this guy that he's putting in second in command of Egypt. Paul.
Well, Joseph, like Daniel, were men of such conviction, nothing's going to stray them from belief.
Yes.
The only thing they're going to rebel against if it's commanded by God not to do that.
Yes.
And this was the name change, is commanded by God not to do this.
Right.
You can't take this on. We'll find out later other things were, but this wasn't.
Yes.
In his mind, my conviction is so strong, I don't care what you call me.
Yes.
It's not going to change how I know you.
Yes. Good point. I don't know if we can find out anything more about why, you know, the names. I saw one hand here. Yeah. Mary, maybe
I'm
you have.
I'm curious as to why Daniel still refers to himself as Daniel throughout the book, that he refers to his friends by their new names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, instead of continuing on.
Let's watch that. Marin is pointing out a good thing, that Daniel throughout the book refers to himself as Daniel, but that he refers to the friends by the other names. As I was studying chapter 2, there is an event where they're just all together and they talk to one another using their Hebrew names.
So maybe let's keep an eye out for that as the book goes on to see how the names are used. Because at least in chapter 2, when they're together without the Babylonians, they use the Hebrew names. Okay, let's go on to the next one then. And Wednesday, our question was, why would the food and wine provided by the king defile Daniel? We just had this big discussion about the names and how Daniel doesn't make a big thing out of the names. Why does he make a big deal out of the foods? Our time is kind of coming to an end, so I'm not going to read the text itself. Let's just work on the answers. In the prison or whatever camp Daniel's in, the king always provides his food and his wine for these young men to eat and drink. Why would Daniel make a thing of it? Louisa. Okay. Paul has just made the point. God has not given a command that you must not take on foreign names. But he has given a command about certain foods that we're to eat. And at least in my reading during the week, I discovered that the Babylonian people loved things like pork. And that that would have been a normal thing served.
And it had to be prepared a certain way for the Jewish people.
Remember all the blood being drained out in order for there to be no blood in the meat? Brian?
Similar to a situation that Paul later addressed is eating this food can be seen by others as acceptance of their religious practices because the food is offered to their idols and their gods.
Yes.
So here's an opportunity where the name could just be a title. Here's an opportunity to show by their living that they honor the true God.
Yes. Oftentimes in these countries, there would be a ceremony that took place at the beginning of the meal where a part of it was offered to the god. And so was Daniel staying away from all of the food because this had been offered to a god and it was viewed as something that a Jewish person should not touch. Joyce, did you have anything additional to that? Okay, very good. Paul?
I think that all these Jewish people had Leviticus chapter 11 to their brain. They knew what they should not do. And this is spelled out exactly. You don't eat this
Mm-hmm. The thing that intrigues me about it is the wine thing. I do not know of a command in the Old Testament that Jewish people couldn't drink wine. Go ahead. Yeah, that's the only explanation. Then it would have to be because a libation had been made to the god by pouring some wine out of the cup, and that would have been the reason then for not touching the wine. Another thing, however, Blake had brought up in our discussion in Romans, when there was some discussion about should I eat certain foods, he said that a Muslim person will not eat any meat if they go into a restaurant because they're not sure what the makers at the restaurant put into meats. So even if it's not pork, they won't eat it in that setting because there's any possibility of contamination. And so that may have been Daniel's reasons too. Why should I even touch any of this food? Because I don't know how the Babylonian guy has prepared it. And so I'm just going to completely keep separate from it. Okay, that is as much time as we were able to cover. I would like to keep our pace going, however, so I am going to start at chapter 2 next time. If you do have individual questions about some areas we didn't cover, I don't have to go to late service. I went to early. I could stay after and talk to you. Also, if you could help us load chairs, that would be helpful as well. Thank you. Abednego. Azariah is the Lord has helped. And Abednego is servant of either Nego or Nebo. There's two different spellings for that God's name. Servant of Nebo.